John chapter 11, we're going to be looking at verses 47 and down through the beginning part of chapter 12. I've entitled the message tonight, Hatred of Jesus Increases. Hatred of Jesus Increases. You know, we ask ourselves an important question. Why did the chief priests and the Pharisees hate Jesus? Or why they hated Jesus? Why would it be that they hated Jesus like they did? You know, we could say, well, you know, maybe it was because they hated his miracles. I doubt it. You know, everybody likes a miracle. If it was your grandma that was dying and she got healed, you'd be happy even if it was somebody you didn't like. I don't think it was the miracles. Maybe it was the fact that they said he worked for Satan. I doubt that too. I don't think they really believed that. They used it as an excuse. I really don't think that they thought that his miracles were from Satan. I think they were just throwing that out to cause trouble. Maybe it was because they hated his teaching. Well, there's some probably truth to that. They didn't like what he said. But deep down inside, I don't think that was necessarily what it was. He did expose their hypocrisy, and they didn't like that, and they didn't like some of the things that he said about them. But I think the real main reason that they hated Jesus was this. They were jealous. They were jealous. They didn't like the fact that this teacher had thousands of people following him. The scribes and Pharisees, you know, they'd strut through the temple and with their fancy clothes and the bells and things on tinkling, and everybody bowed to them. And they liked all the honor, but they didn't have the thousands of people following them. People didn't love them like they loved Jesus. People didn't come out in the wilderness by the thousands to see them. They couldn't do miracles. They couldn't see. They couldn't do the things. They didn't have the power that Jesus had. The people said, Jesus speaks with authority, not like these scribes and the Pharisees. And the scribes and the Pharisees knew all these things. And so I think that the main reason that they hated Jesus was because they were jealous of him. And we see that hatred intensifying as we get toward the end of chapter 12 and 11 and into 12. And tonight we're going to begin with verse number 47. Verse number 47, it says, "And then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, 'What do we? For this man doth many miracles.'" Now, some important things here we need to notice here. The chief priests and the Pharisees were concerned. They were concerned. It was just after Lazarus rose from the dead. Word got out. Word got back to them. You won't believe it. Jesus, know what he did this time? Lazarus has been dead 4 days and he raised him from the dead. And we were there and saw the whole thing. We know what happened. And they brought this message back to the Pharisees and they were alarmed. What are we going to do? This is getting out of hand. We've got to stop this guy because it's causing us trouble. And so they were very concerned. And it says that they called a council. Now, important for us to note here, the word council is actually the Greek word Sanhedrin. They called a Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin was a meeting of all of the... There were 71 Jewish leaders that got together, probably based on what took place way back in the book of Genesis or Exodus. Was it Exodus? Exodus, I guess. Exodus, where God told Moses to choose 70 men to help him judge the people. And the 71st man was the chief priest, which would have represented Moses. All right, so there's 71, and there were the priests, which were partly Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, the Sadducees and Pharisees, what was the difference between the Sadducees and Pharisees? Well, a very simple way to remember what the Sadducees were, it's perhaps maybe too simplified, but it'll help me, it helps me, and maybe it'll help you. The Sadducees were sad, you see, because they didn't believe in the resurrection. All right? The Sadducees were sad, you see, because they didn't believe in the resurrection. And so that'll help you remember what the Sadducees were. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in miracles. They didn't believe in any of the supernatural stuff. So they said, you know, if it's not hard and facts, then we don't believe it. You know, we don't believe any of this stuff. So that was the Sadducees. They were kind of a dead group among the priests. But then there was the Pharisees, and the Pharisees believed all those kind of things, but they were more of the proud, arrogant crowd. Very knowledgeable in Scripture, but not interested in what Jesus had to teach. So the Sanhedrin was made up of 70 of these men. And they got together to have a council. So in this council, just to give us an idea of what this is like, I've got two different articles here from Bible dictionaries. The first says that the Sanhedrin was a council of 71 individuals around the time of Christ that was comprised of Pharisees and Sadducees who governed the Jewish nation while under the rule of Rome. It often served as a court to settle legal and religious matters. Another dictionary adds this, says, Rome gave the Sanhedrin authority to arrest, to judge, to punish the Jewish people for offenses relating to the religious laws and for certain civil offenses. One exception concerned the death sentence. All right, so they could pass all these things, but they couldn't pass the death sentence. That's why, and we'll see as we get to that point, when they brought Jesus in to Pilate, Pilate says, go judge him of your own selves. And they said, we can't. We want the death sentence. That's why they had to come to Pilate, because Pilate was the Roman governor. All right, so they could pass other sentences against him, but they didn't want other sentences. They wanted a death. And so they had to seek the Roman permission for the death sentence. And so that's what that was all about. So the Sanhedrin gets together to decide what they're going to do. Now, Caiaphas was the leader of he was the chief priest at this time. We see down in verse number 48, it says, if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation. And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest the same year, said unto them, ye know nothing at all. And then he goes on to say something, and we'll look at that in just a moment. So Caiaphas here is the high priest. Now, God uses something. You know, God, do you believe this, that God can use wicked men to do what his purpose is? He can. And he does. You know, we look at our world today and we think, oh, you know, what's God going to do? You know, all we got is wicked people in charge of our world today. Well, God can rule in wicked people's lives as well. And he can use wicked people to do things that they don't necessarily even think of themselves. God can put thoughts in their minds to do things that he wants them to do. And that's exactly what takes place here. Here's a wicked man who doesn't believe in Jesus Christ, and God uses him to say something that was supernatural, that God put in his heart. Look at verse number 49. Or 50, verse 50, nor consider, he says, you know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation perish not. And then John adds, and this spake he not of himself, or not from himself, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for that nation. He didn't even realize what he was doing, but God allowed him to make a prophecy that Jesus would die for the nation. What he was saying is, listen, fellas, it's better that we kill him than lose our nation. And so we've got to get rid of this Jesus guy because he's going to destroy our nation. They were afraid that there was going to be an uproar, and if there was an uproar, the Romans may come down and quash it and take away the authority that the Sanhedrin presently had to kind of govern the nation. And so, if this uproar came up, the Romans would come in and quash all that, take away the Sanhedrin's power, and put them under a strict Roman control, and they would lose what power they had. And so, they didn't want that to happen. They said, it's better that one man die than that the whole nation be destroyed. And yet, he was actually saying something that was very prophetic. One man had to die that all of us might live. And that Jesus Christ was that one who died in our place. Wonderful, wonderful truth there, but Caiaphas had no idea what he was really saying. And so they discussed how they could put Jesus to death. They were concerned about this. They're discussing this, trying to figure out, what are we going to do? Verse 53, and from that day forth, they took counsel together to put him to death. They were trying to decide, you know, how can we get rid of this guy? We've got to put him to death. And you know, it's good for us to remember that God is able to use hatred and plots of evil men to fulfill his will. We see that throughout the Bible, different times that took place. God is still able to do that, and it's an encouragement, especially when we have wicked leaders of our nations that are godless and leading our nations further and further into corruption. Some of the things I've read about the American president, his agenda to promote homosexuality worldwide and to promote wickedness. Just unbelievable that it could be coming from the nation's highest leader. And yet, God is allowing some of that. And you know, it could be that God is allowing that to destroy the nation of America so that the power is not there, so that when the tribulation comes in and all of the other things that is centered around Europe, I don't know. We don't know. But all one thing we do know is God's still in control. God's in control. And we have nothing to fear. And it's important for us to remember that. Now, at the same time, God does urge us to pray for the peace of our leaders. He says, pray for that your leaders will give you peace. And so we do pray for their peace, but at the same time, we pray for God's will to be done. And as I pray for my nation and pray for this nation, this is my nation as well, I've got two nations. As I pray for the two countries that are part of my life, you know, I pray for the leadership in both these countries and pray that God's will would be done. And that God, you would use those people that are in charge, our president and our prime minister, to do your will, even though they're godless and unconcerned about spiritual things, that God's will would be done. So we need to pray for our nations, but pray for God's will. Then also we see here that Jesus then does something. He hides to await the Passover. Verse number 54, Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence into the country near to the wilderness, into the city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. So here we find that Jesus leaves the area and again goes down toward Jericho. Ephraim, most likely, I mean, they don't know for positive where the city was, but they're pretty sure that it was a city up on a hillside overlooking the Jordan Valley, right down near the Jordan Valley, down toward the area of Jericho. And Jesus goes down in there. It's a wilderness area. It's out where there's not very many people out in the country. And he goes to this little country town called Ephraim, and he stays there and is awaiting the Passover. Now, the Passover is coming closer, and Jesus knows. You know, I often wonder the temptation that was on Christ must have been immense. He knew what was ahead. He knew the Passover was coming. He knew at the Passover he would die. He knew all of those things. He knew that he would be crucified. He knew all that. And you know, if we know something bad's coming, we do everything we can to avoid it. But Jesus marched on. And he did not stick around Jerusalem at this point because he knew that his time to die was at the Passover. And I believe it was a fulfillment of the Passover picture in the Old Testament. He was the Passover lamb. The lamb in the Old Testament Passover was only a type. Jesus Christ was the antitype. He was the real thing. And he was the Passover lamb that would die for the sins of the whole world. And so he had to wait till the Passover. And he knew that. And he knew all these things. And so just, you know, amazing when you start to think about all these things that were coming to pass here. So Jesus goes over there. And it's this town was just a short day's journey. It wasn't even a full day's journey. A short day's journey from Jerusalem. And, you know, when persecution comes our way, and we may in our lifetime face persecution, I think that's very likely. And when persecution comes our way, what are we supposed to do? Is it wrong to try to escape? I don't think so. Jesus did. Jesus knew trouble was coming, so he escaped. He went over to these places and, so to speak, hid. It wasn't like he was hiding up in a house or whatever, but he was staying away from the crowds and staying out of the main area there. But we also need to be willing to suffer when the persecution may come. I don't think there's any glory in looking for persecution. You know, there's been some down through the ages that almost went looking for trouble because they wanted to be a martyr. Well, I don't think there's any merit in trying to become a martyr. If that becomes your fate, then so be it. God's in control, but I don't think we need to go looking for martyrdom. And so Jesus went away and tried to stay away from the area there. When I used that word fate, I wasn't meaning it in any bad way. That may not have been a right term to use there, but our destiny, our end, is to what I was referring to there. Then it says that many of the people looked for Jesus. Verse number 55, and the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, And many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. And they sought for Jesus and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple. What think ye? That he will come to the feast? All right, so here they're talking. They're going up to the feast. They're traveling. And as they're traveling, they're chatting. And as they get to Jerusalem, they're in the temple and wondering, you know that Jesus guy, you think he'll come to the feast? I mean, they're trying to kill him. You think he'll have the courage to come? They had no idea what was coming. They had no idea that the cross was coming. They had no idea of any of that. But so they're talking among themselves. Do you think he'll really come? Do you think he'll have the courage to come? What will happen if they stand up to him? Well, you know, let's hang around. Maybe we'll see something exciting here. You know, all kinds of talk might have been going on. The people were anticipating what was going to take place here. But we see that the chief priests were also anticipating this in verse 57. Now, both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he was, he should show it, that they might take him. All right, so they had already put out word, and it was spreading around Jerusalem. If you know where this Jesus guy is, you better report it to the Pharisees and the chief priests, because they have made a law. You've got to do this. All right, so that may have been one of the laws that they passed in the Sanhedrin. Could be. They were doing those kind of things. All right, now, we move on to chapter 12, and things change gears a little bit, but not really. It's just a step in the same direction. Verse number 1, then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. And they made him a supper. And Martha served, and Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table. Now let's stop and think about this for a moment. Jesus comes back to Bethany. He wasn't very far from Bethany. Bethany was close to Jerusalem. He was only a partial day's journey down to Ephraim. So he leaves Ephraim down in the valley nearer to the Jordan, walks up to Bethany. Now Bethany is only a Sabbath day journey from Jerusalem, just a real short way from Jerusalem. But it's up on the hill, or just over the hill of the Mount of Olives, on the other side of the Mount of Olives, and Jesus comes there to Bethany. Now that's pretty close to enemy territory. And he knew that. But there, we don't know why, we don't know any of the situation. Perhaps Mary and Martha and Lazarus knew where Jesus was. They had communicated with him and actually invited Jesus to come. Maybe Jesus just showed up. I don't know. But Martha puts on a meal. You know, we see that every time you see Martha, what is she doing? She's serving. She's being hospitable. She's being a help. You know, in our lives for Christ, there's something for all of us to do. You know, some of you feel a bit intimidated by talking to people and being more outgoing and open. But you can be hospitable. You can open up your home. You can invite people in. You can be a blessing to people. You can help in little ways. There's always something we can do to serve. Maybe serving at the local church. You can serve in our home or serving. Open up your home for an activity or any of these kind of things. You know, we can do those kind of things to be a blessing to others. So Martha was the hospitable girl. Lazarus here, it says that he sat at the table with them as they ate. And significant here because they're emphasizing that Lazarus was there. Now, something important for us to picture. We usually get the wrong idea. It says he sat at the table with the rest of them. That doesn't mean what we often think. Here's a table, pull up a chair, sit down and have lunch with us. They didn't sit at tables like this. The word table there literally means reclining together for a meal. Reclining together for a meal. What they did typically in that culture is they had in the center of the room sometimes a small little table just raised off the ground a little tiny bit, or a mat that they would put on the floor in the center of the room. And they would often have cushions spread around the mat or table, that little tiny table in the middle. And the food would go on the table in the middle. They'd often have a big dish in the middle, and then you just kind of dipped out of the dish. Either dipped out of it into a smaller dish for your food, or sometimes just everybody ate out of the big dish. Not real sanitary, but that's what they did. But then around the table, they would recline. They would lie on their side. Now, I'll probably get this wrong. I forget which side it was. Anyway, I think they reclined on their left side, if I recall right. They'd recline on the left side and then eat with the right hand. So their heads were all into the center, kind of like the spokes of something. All right, if the table was in the middle, and they'd all recline around the table like this, with their heads toward the middle of the table. And then that way they could reach up and get the food out of the table. And that's why we find later on when it talks about John being the one who leaned upon Jesus' breast. What that means is if this one here was Jesus, John was here, all right, and if he leaned back, he was actually leaning back onto Jesus as he was sitting around the table. That's what it's talking about here, is they're around the table. And so they're around the table eating. So this is what it means here when it speaks of that being around the table. Then Mary is the one that really seems to have a passionate love for Jesus. Not an intimate love in a girlfriend type of a way, but a love for him as the Messiah. And she brings costly ointment called spikenard. And she pours the bottle of ointment on his feet. All right, now picture again here with me. All right, if his feet are down here and his head's up here, all right, and he's reclining there, she's down here, she comes up behind Jesus, pours this ointment on his feet. All right, you get the larger room here, and she's comes around the side and pours the ointment on Jesus' feet, and then she takes her long hair, unwrapped it, and brought it down and wiped his feet with her hair. And that was a significant thing for two reasons. First of all, the ointment was very expensive, so it cost her a great deal. But washing a person's feet was the job of the slave. Nobody but the slave washed your feet. Because that was, even today, I could think of a lot nicer jobs than come and wash your feet. Right? And we don't do that today, but if we did, that wouldn't be my choice job to get stuck on washing somebody's smelly feet. They probably didn't smell nearly as bad as some today that are cooped up in shoes because they wore sandals and things like that. But anyway, it was humiliating to wash his feet. It was also humiliating to take down her hair and dry his feet. Because their culture, the women had long hair and they would always keep their hair up. Because the ones that wore it down loose were often, not always, but often, were the immoral women. And so to take her hair down and to dry his feet with her hair was also humiliating. But she was willing to do that and even be accused, if so be, of being inappropriate to do that because she loved Jesus. And so she was willing to humble herself, sacrifice her money, humiliate herself in this way to honor the Lord Jesus Christ. Judas, however, didn't like it. We see down in verse number 4, then says one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? He starts complaining. You know, he probably punched Peter. Hey, Peter, what do you think? What a waste. That stuff must have been worth 300 pence. Why wouldn't they sell that and give it to the poor? What a waste to pour it on Jesus' feet. What a waste. And he's grumbling and complaining. And then John tells us here, verse number 6, this he said not because he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare that which was in therein, that was put therein. All right, so Judas apparently was the disciples' treasurer. And he was a thief. And he didn't like the fact that this money was given, wasted, as he thought, on Jesus' feet. Because if they would have sold the money and gave it to him as the treasurer, he probably could have, taken a little bit for himself. It was just a little commission for caring for the money. And he had a little bit for himself. But he was a thief. He was not interested in the poor. He didn't care about the poor. But he just used that as an excuse. And so Judas here was a bad example for us to follow. Now, Judas is really the opposite of Mary when you think about it. Mary gave, Judas wanted to take. Mary loved Jesus openly, Judas secretly hated Jesus. Mary was generous toward Jesus, Judas was greedy toward Jesus. We need to try to be more like Mary and less like Judas. Our flesh is prone to be like Judas, but we need to be like Mary. And a great testimony there. Then we find, as he wraps up this section here, we find that Lazarus' testimony endangers his very life. Verse 9 says, much people of the Jews, therefore, knew that he was there, Jesus was there at Bethany, And they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death, because that by reason of him, many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus. So the situation here is that they are angry at Lazarus too. So word gets around. Jesus is at Bethany. Jesus is in Bethany. You know, back in Jerusalem, they're already gathering for the Passover, and the Jews are talking, wonder if he'll come, wonder if he'll come. And somebody says, hey, you know, I heard he's over at Bethany. Hey, you know, we got the afternoon off tomorrow. Let's go see him. All right. So people were coming all over. The news is spreading that Jesus is at Bethany. Bethany's just over the hill. Only take a couple hours. Let's go over there and see him. All right. Yeah, let's go. So they walk over. People were coming by the flocks over to Bethany to see Jesus. But also, they're saying, hey, you know, while we're there, let's take a look at this Lazarus guy. I hear he rose from the dead after 4 days from being dead. That's pretty amazing. Let's go see for ourselves. And people were coming by the flocks over there. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all these chief priests were angry now, because the popularity of Lazarus is bringing more and more and more people to Jesus. So they said, all right, I guess we're going to have to kill Lazarus too. Real nice mob, you know. These are the spiritual leaders. Let's kill Lazarus too, so he'll stop being a testimony for Jesus. And so we see these things happening as it's coming to a conclusion here. And these hateful leaders are against what is taking place. Now, as we just kind of recap this section here, I think there's some really good things we can learn here tonight from the testimonies of the people involved. Martha, the hospitable, caring, helpful lady. You know, we can all do that. We can all get involved in some way, be a blessing, be a help, have somebody over and be an encouragement to them. We can do that. You don't have to be an orator. You don't have to be a preacher. You don't have to stand up and, you know, lead a group. Just open your home. Have somebody over for fellowship around the Lord. And that can be a blessing. That's a great thing that you can do. You know, one thing that you can do is we look to the future. I got a real blessing this week. The director of Baptist World Mission, the mission that I'm with, his name is Dr. Bud Stedman. And I know him. I don't know him real well, but he's a great preacher, a really good preacher, a really good preacher. He was a pastor of a huge church before he took this position as the leader of the mission. And he wrote me this week, and he said, if it's okay with you and the other missionaries that are in New Zealand, he says, I'm going to come over and see you guys in July or August. And I thought, yeah, great. And I wrote him back, says, come on over, stay as long as you want. And I said, but make sure you bring your preaching when you come. I want some good sermons while you're here. And so he'll be coming with us. There's an opportunity. Another thing that's a possibility, and this is more vague of a possibility, but a couple weeks ago, the pastor of my home church back in the States, his name is Pastor Lyle Oman. And he wrote in, and he just said, you know, you need a visit sometime? And I wrote him back and said, sure, Pastor, anytime, come visit. Yeah, I don't know whether he'll be able to or not, but that'd be great. But you know, when we have opportunities like that, if somebody comes for a visit, or even when Benjamin and Lorne are here, don't feel bad about saying, you know, Pastor, could I have them over for a meal, or could I have them over for a cup of tea, or, you know, that's fine. That's your opportunities to be a Martha, and to be a blessing to them, and get to know them, and to just be hospitable. Use those kind of opportunities. That's perfectly fine. You're not going to hurt my feelings, and if we already have something planned, we'll just say, well, I'm sorry, we already got something planned. But, you know, that's an opportunity. But there's Martha to be like. Then there's Mary. We can be like Mary. To sacrifice for Jesus. To sacrifice for the things of God. I mean, she gave abundantly. It wasn't just a little bit. She gave a lot. This was very expensive. And she gave it out of love for Jesus. We can give. We can give of ourselves. We can give of our time. We can give of our finances. We can give to bless others in the work of the Lord. And that's what the local church is all about, is working together to advance the cause of Christ. And we can do that. We can all get involved and be more like Mary. And one thing we don't want to be like is we don't want to be like Judas. We can learn from Judas. Judas was a hypocrite. On the outside, he had the big smile and all is well. I mean, everybody must have liked him. Why would he choose him to be the treasurer? You know, nobody suspected that he was the one that was going to betray Jesus. He was just one of the gang, one of the guys. You know, everybody liked him. And then afterwards they could see, oh yeah, well we see it now, but we didn't see it then. And so he was a hypocrite. He put on a good front on the outside, but inside he was on the other side. He was not on Jesus' side. He hated Jesus, and this hatred was growing and growing. And toward the end here, now he's so upset, and we'll see next week, he actually turns on Jesus and says, all right, I'm gonna sell him. I'm going to turn him in because I want some money out of this deal. And I'm tired of Jesus, you know, making all these wastes and things like this. So let's not be like Judas. Judas was a greedy. He was selfish. He was a thief. He hated Jesus inwardly. He was a hypocrite. All the wrong things to be. But Mary and Martha are great examples for us to be, to follow. So from those things tonight, we can learn some great things that we can follow. Be humble. Be a servant. Be willing to serve and humble ourselves to serve the Lord in a great way. God will bless us if we do.